Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
We're just another band from Boston, which was completely made up because he did the whole thing in his basement studio.
All right. Hey, everyone. Patrick Foster here on behalf of Jim Lanahan. I want to welcome you to this episode of Rockin' the Suburbs. We have a guest that I'm very, very excited to have on the show. Probably one of the first people that listened to the old podcast and got in touch with us. And not only was it exciting that he got in touch with us, but it was where he got in touch with us from that also made us very excited. Folks, on the podcast today is, for you very longtime listeners, George from Hong Kong, now George from West Virginia. But George, thank you so much for being here.
Glad to be here.
So how have you been, for everyone's benefit? I know that we were talking a little bit before we turned the mics on, and you were working over there in Hong Kong, and then kind of the pandemic came, and like it did for a lot of people, kind of blew things up. But you're back in West Virginia now.
Yep, I worked in Hong Kong. I worked after graduating from West Virginia University, worked in Atlanta for a while, and got transferred to Hong Kong. And I worked there. I got transferred on a two-year contract and wound up working for 25 years in Hong Kong, Beijing, and then Hong Kong. And we moved back to Charleston in West Virginia about 6 years ago.
Okay, cool. George, it's wonderful to have you, but I really am intrigued by this topic. George sent an email a while back, noted the fact that I was unaware of this, that this week, actually, marks the 50th anniversary of the release of one of the most iconic rock and roll albums of all time, and perhaps the most iconic debut album of all time. We're talking about the first album from Boston, came out on August 25th of 1976. And you got this album, George, when you were in college, is that right?
Yeah, I was just starting out at the fall semester as a senior at WVU, and had gone to this party at a house. And of course, it's a college town, so it's not a house where parents are. It's students rented. And they were playing this album, and I remember it was being played very loud. But nice. It was so unbelievably catchy, and everybody started talking about, wow, what is it? It's this new band called Boston. And I thought, man, this is just terrific. It was so well crafted. Sonic and the guitars really stood out. It sounded different from the things that had been done before or that were around it in 1976. And so the very next day, I went out and bought it in vinyl.
Nice. I love it.
I didn't know anything about the band. I didn't realize that it wasn't really a band, that it was one guy, Tom Scholz, who basically created the entire thing in his basement with the assistance of a drummer. I didn't know anything about that. I thought it was a full-fledged band that had put this together. They even had that song about rock and roll band, which was this mythical creation about, we're just another band from Boston, which was completely made up because he did the whole thing in his basement studio.
Money. It's such a fascinating record to me, and I didn't get this album until I probably was in high school, so probably in the early 80s. And, you know, around here, we had a couple of big classic rock stations in the DC area, and it was just, you heard it a lot. But the amazing thing about it, George, was that you didn't just hear one or two songs. You heard like four or five different ones that were in rotation, you know, from this album, which was kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah. In fact, I've in doing some research for this, I didn't just want to wax enthusiastic about the, you know, the album, but to put some meat behind it, is that actually it was one of the albums that helped expand the format of album-oriented radio, because prior to that, most albums would have one or two cuts that would be played on the radio. With this, seven or eight cuts were played pretty much continuously on the radio. And even today on classic rock radio, you will hear them.
It's amazing that you still hear them like in regular rotation. It's really incredible. And that was, you know, there's a couple things about Boston that were sort of first for me. And one was the fact that when I got this album, it was kind of like I knew the songs already. You know, a lot of times you'd buy an album and you'd put on the first song on side one because you knew that one. And then maybe you knew another one. And then the second side maybe was a total adventure. But this one, I was like familiar with the whole thing. It was so cool to buy an album where I kind of knew all the songs. It was awesome.
Yeah. Almost everybody I knew within a year had the album. And at the time, I know it was the fastest selling debut album in history. I think that Guns N' Roses' Appetite for Destruction has now supplanted that. I think it's the second fastest debut in history. And, you know, it only took 3 months from its release till it went platinum. And then 9 months later, the time, I guess, you could have a baby, It sold 6.5 million copies, and it went on to sell 17 million copies. By the way, this on a label that originally not only rejected them, but according to an interview Tom Scholz did, which you can find online, is that it was the one record company, one label that not only rejected it, but rejected him in the most insulting letter possible from any of the record labels. And they wound up, through twists and turns internally, ultimately signing himself and Brad Delp, who was also, got to give props to, just an incredible vocal.
So you put together some wonderful notes for this, George. So take us through a little bit. This is really an unusual story in rock and roll history. It's not a story of a band, you know, like you mentioned on the song Rock and Roll Band. They weren't a band trying to make it around and playing in, you know, clubs and all that for years. And there was a couple different groups, I guess, that Tom Scholz had played with, you know, occasionally. But he was an engineering student, right?
Yeah. In fact, he had a master's degree in electrical engineering from MIT. Yeah. While he was in school, he started writing and recording music. And you're right. He had a couple of bands before that cut a couple of demos, and they just didn't go anywhere. And the bands didn't last that long either. But he, after the breakup of his, I think, second band, he decided, I'm just going to do it myself. And he began to build a studio in his basement with the money he was making as a full-time Polaroid employee. At the time, of course, Polaroid was a very big company that involved a lot of engineering. And he was a full-time employee at Polaroid. And so he began to build a studio in his basement with the money, the proceeds from Polaroid. And that was a regular house. The house still exists in Waterton, Massachusetts. And there's a video online you can go, and they surprise the lady that lives there now. And Tom Scholz walks in and says, "Hey, I recorded an album in this basement." But, you know, and they recorded some demos, got no attention. So then after that, he went into a studio and with vocalist Brad Delp, who had played with a previous band, and a guy named Jim Masada, I think that's pronunciation, on drums. And he began to cut the demos that wound up, the demo that he started to shop around to record labels. He got rejection labels from, or rejection letters from basically everybody. And the one from Epic was particularly insulting, if you recall. But then through, you know, twists and turns, Epic decides they actually like it. And they offer a recording contract to both him and Jim Mazdia, the drummer. And so they signed both of those to a recording contract. By the way, I don't think that they knew at the time that Tom Scholz was in his basement doing basically all of the instruments, keyboard, rhythm guitar, acoustic guitar, electric guitar, sonic sounds with devices that he built himself as an electrical engineer, and just using, and even playing some of the drum parts himself. And basically, it's a do-it-yourself album. It's not some, quote, corporate rock album. It's not, you know, it's a do-it-yourself album that he did in his basement, despite the fact it sounds extremely polished.
It really does, yeah.
And so what happened was that Epic finally signed them, but they insisted that, okay, demos are great, but now you need to do this in a professional studio.
Right.
We're going to send you off to the West Coast. You're going to redo all these songs in a studio on the West Coast with a professional producer.
Right. And
so this became a little point of disagreement between him and the basically the label. And what happened was that he kind of cut an agreement with the producer and said, I'm going to continue to do this work in the basement. Producer agreed. And they sent a fake, they sent Brad Delp and sort of like a couple of guys to the West Coast. And I think they did a little bit of work on Hitch a Ride or on what's the last song on the album?
Yeah, I got my copy right here. Let Me Take You Home Tonight.
Yeah, I think they did a little bit of work on that.
Okay.
And but anyway, so they basically faked the studio out by all he did was polish up the cuts in his basement. There's a tiny bit of work done on the West Coast, and then they turned in the tape, and the label loved it.
It's an incredible story. It really is. It's amazing. I did not know that part. I knew it was home recorded, but I didn't have any idea that, you know, they actually sent a couple guys out to LA to record in a studio.
Yeah, the label, you know, at the time, I guess labels were very insistent that you had to have professionally produced material, and this was not. But this was his last shot. He has said on interviews you can find online that this last demo, you know, he was 30 years old. He'd spent all his money, all his time. And if this didn't work, he was going to sell all the equipment and buckle down and really be a good employee and engineer at Polaroid because, I mean, he fesses up. He'd been slacking off, goes to work late, leaves early, because he's working on his music. So he was going to focus and become a professional. But instead, the demo worked.
Yeah.
so amazing. And, you know, I think as these things happen, I think it was really interesting that the producer they got to work with him recognized how well crafted and how well made these songs were.
It was John Boylan.
John Boylan, okay.
Who produced it. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, was perfectly fine with the plan that,
right.
You know, Tom works in Boston in his basement, and he covers for him basically on the West Coast.
It's so interesting, too. And, you know, I think because they were a brand new group and had never put anything out before, you would imagine that, you know, CBS, Epic weren't particularly pinning, like, you know, huge hopes on this record. You know, they thought they would get what they would get and maybe it would take off. And it has to be one of the greatest values ever in rock and roll history for the amount of money spent on the recording to what they made from these millions and millions of albums sold all over the world.
Yeah. I think that in the U.S. sales, they've sold between 17 and 18 million copies of the debut album.
That's incredible.
I think worldwide, it's closer to 20 million. You know, this was an album, or this was, you know, stuff that basically, I believe that the final demo tape he sent around, only one song didn't actually make the final cut, make the final album, which is incredible.
Wow, that is incredible.
Basically, they bought the demo tape.
That's just incredible. It's an amazing story. And you mentioned, too, in your notes that this doesn't stop with, like, our generation of people. This album continues to be listened to by, like, all kinds of different people, right?
Even from the early days, I got a buddy of mine, and I was telling him about, you know, the anniversary. And he said, wow, Boston, that's my buddy Craig. I worked with him both in Atlanta and in Hong Kong, believe it or not.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he said the very first concert he ever went to was Boston.
No way.
Lakewood, Florida. And he said it was probably 77. And it just blew him away. Not because it was the first concert, but just the sonic quality.
Yeah.
Was just incredible. The hooks, the songs. And then I've got a friend of mine who's like 15 years younger. And when I mentioned the anniversary to her, she said, oh, my goodness. We listened to Boston all through high school and college. This is 15 years after its initial release.
That's amazing. It's so amazing that it really is.
And my son plays guitar, and he knows, you know, he knows basically every song. They're great guitar
songs. That's
incredible. Though you would have difficulty achieving the sonic sounds at home without some type of electronic assistance.
You certainly would. And, you know, I think that was another thing that was so appealing to me when I first started hearing these songs, is that there wasn't a lot that sounded like it. I mean, it wasn't heavy metal, and it wasn't, you know, like Skynyrd or Southern rock, and it wasn't pop music, really. And then, you know, later you can, after you learn about these things, you can piece things together and you can understand that he put power pop with rock and roll, and the hooks are just, you know, so outstanding.
It also happened as an interesting time because you had disco and punk that were just beginning, 76. So right. You had disco already beginning, just the early stages to emerge. Punk was about to happen. And then prior to that, you had more straight ahead. You had Southern rock and you had more hard rock. I mean, Toys in the Attic, I think, had been released earlier that year. But
yep.
You didn't have anybody that sounded like Boston. The guitars sounded completely different than anything that was on the air.
Yeah, they really did.
And what's interesting is that this also, from what I've read, impacted AOR, album-oriented rock radio as well, because previous to this, there had been people would play one or two cuts off an album. But, you know, with this album, you could play basically every cut. And it really gave probably greater depth to the artist than you would get off of just playing a hit single.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Yeah. And you know, when it came out, it was a piece, you know, it wasn't something where even today, when you look at the track listing, I mean, maybe More Than a Feeling slightly would be considered like the hit song or maybe Rock and Roll Band, but not really. I mean, all of them, I think, you know, like we were saying, they hold up. And do you have a favorite, George, or a couple of favorites on the record?
That's difficult to do. But, you know, Rock and Roll Band,
yeah.
Smokin', they're just both, you know, songs that most of the songs, they're just irresistible. Those would be two that probably stand out a little bit more. But overall, every song has got great hooks in it.
That's the thing about it. And I think you rightly say Brad Delp really does a great job with the vocals on this record, because it's instantly recognizable that it's Boston when you hear him, you know, start to sing over those guitars. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not an expert on vocals, but he has got an incredible range.
Yeah.
And I do know that they, you know, that they multi-tracked him. So he did not only the lead vocals, but he did all the background harmonies himself, and they would just layer those in.
Oh, is that right? Interesting. I didn't know that. That's very cool. That gives it that wider resolution and big screen kind of feel.
I think I read online he's got a 2.5 octave range.
Wow.
He's now passed, unfortunately. But
yeah.
I mean, he just had an incredible vocal range, which complemented, I think, the range of guitar tones that you find on the album.
Yeah, great point. Yeah, it really does. And, you know, you get, when you read about it at least, and then you think about the songs or listen to them, you know, Schultz was trying to create these perfect songs. Like he, like you said, it was his last shot, and he was going to try to put everything exactly where he wanted it, including those vocals.
He was a perfectionist. If you read about him, he would play something by himself. By the way, he would just play something over and over and over and over until he. Well, and also he built some of his own equipment.
Yeah.
He built crazy things like the Power Soak, it's called. So you know, he's in a basement, and if he turns it up to 10. He's going to lose his hearing pretty quickly.
Right.
and this thing allowed it to sound like you're playing at full volume when actually you're not playing at full volume.
Interesting.
And he built a thing called the hyperspace pedal, which allowed him to do infinite sustain for single and multiple tones.
Wow.
And he modified several devices of his own so that he could create guitar tones that I can still remember being in that house the first time I heard it. I thought, what in the world is happening with these guys? You know, it's just incredible. And he would work and work and work as a perfectionist on a song until it was perfect.
You know, and I remember there was rumors or stories going around at that time, or in the early 80s when I started getting into music a lot more heavily. And they were like, oh, yeah, it turns out, you know, the Boston album, they made that all with computers. Like that was, you know, it was totally artificial.
Actually, for the second album, they had heard those rumors themselves, the label and Tom. And so for the second album, they actually put on that album, you may vaguely remember, they said something like no computers, no synthesizers or something like
that.
Oh,
right.
On the, I do remember that.
Yes, on the album liner note.
Just to make it clear.
Yes, just to make it clear, this guy did all of this. And by the way, they didn't even have samplers then.
No.
You know, or sequence. This was done in 1976. So, yeah, they had pedals and effects pedals and filters and things like that. But they didn't have the equipment you have today.
Right, right.
There's, in one of the audio tour or video tours he does, he's got little splices of actual tape up against one post. And they're like 1 second snippets of something didn't like. And there must be 20 of them. And he would play exactly what he wanted and splice that in.
Wow.
And then remove the piece. And it's like souvenirs. And there must be 20 of them on the wall because he wanted that perfect moment. And until he achieved it, he worked and he would cut out tape.
That's amazing. And that's the other thing. No digital editing was available. He actually had to cut and splice that stuff. That is mind-blowing.
And he's doing that himself in the basement also.
Yeah.
That is incredible.
You know, I think it does help to be an electrical engineer. He did say that in an interview, he said, the benefit of being a musician and an engineer is you eliminate the communication between the two. Because in essence, Patrick, if you're as a guitar player, if you're trying to describe a particular sound to the engineer, you know, I mean, how do you actually do that if it's a sound, especially if it's a sound that no one else has ever created?
Right.
You can't. But if you're the engineer and the musician, you can sit down with your guitar and your pedal and, you know, and play with a bunch of different stuff, you know, resistors, all this, and achieve the sound you hear in your head.
I did a little bit of research on the cover of the album because it's very iconic. You know, I know this makes for great podcasting, but I think you all know the cover. It's like the earth, I guess, is blowing up and all these guitars are fleeing the earth, flying away, and Boston is leading the way. But I read briefly that they had rejected a whole string of covers that were poor puns on, like, one had a cream pie on the front, you know, for Boston and a bunch of different concepts until the art director at CBS ended up talking to Tom Scholz and actually listening to his idea. And this was his idea. He didn't know how to draw it, but that's what he wanted. He wanted like whole cities inside of a guitar shaped spaceship, like, you know, escaping Earth. And he got it. And it became kind of their look for the rest of, for the rest of their career. It really did. So kind of amazing.
Yeah, you're exactly right. He came up with the idea after he had been presented by the label. As you said, they had Boston cream pie. One of the concepts was a pot of Boston baked beans, a head of Boston lettuce. And Tom said, none of these are going to work. You know, what about, you know, what about a guitar and sort of like a spaceship? And the artist, and I apologize, I don't have his name written down in my notes, but he did it all himself. Tom gives him full credit. It's like, you know, man, the guy came up with something that was spectacularly arresting.
It actually was a she. Her name is Paula Scher, and she was the head of art at CBS. And it kind of fell to her, apparently, like you said, because all these other concepts, the designers tried it all, and they hated them all. So she was like, well, I'll give it a crack. And it turned out to be so incredibly iconic.
You know, one of the strengths of this album, Patrick, I think, is that it doesn't sound sonically dated.
I will agree.
The guitars, do they sound like everybody today? No, but they don't sound like they're 1976. If you went back and looked at albums in the late 70s, you could come up with a lot of examples of things that really do sound dated. But with his guitar sounds, Brad's vocals, and just the sonic treatment, it still sounds completely fresh. You can put the album on in a car if you're going for a drive or something, and man, time just slips away.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. When you hear it, it's one of those groups too that, you know, if you listen to the radio, it was one of those, you don't switch the channel when a Boston song comes on. You always play through that Boston song and you hope it's Tuesday so you get two of them.
That's right. That's right. What's amazing is that they did put together a band and do a lot more to back up the original album. It was something that he had to sort of, you know, create, given that he'd done, you know, almost everything in his own basement.
Yeah, right.
But it was it was extremely successful tour. They sold out, they've sold out arenas, across the United States.
That's amazing. On your first album, it's almost unheard of. Did he quit his job at Polaroid eventually when the album came out?
Yes, he did. He realized that. You know what? What's interesting is his dad said, and he says this in one of the interviews you can find online. His dad said, you know, quit fooling around with music and focus on being an engineer. Because his dad didn't see any future, despite the fact his dad was a musician, had played in a band.
Oh, interesting.
He said, quit fooling around with music, focus on being an engineer, just be a good one. And then when the album broke, he said, oh, okay, great, you know, now you're a full-time musician. Well, what Tom did eventually is, because he'd invented these audio devices, he actually started his own company, which is like Schultz Research and Development, created pedals and gear under the Rockman brand name. And his dad then said, quit fooling around with electronics and get back to music. And then when his company became successful, his dad didn't know what to say. Music and successful in building this this music R&D company. So his dad couldn't say anything further.
You finally got him quiet. That's hilarious. I love it.
He did quit his job at Polaroid as well. In fact, he may have even felt guilty about stealing time away from Polaroid. But I'm sure. Most of his coworkers were proud to say, I worked alongside Tom.
Exactly. Fulton. Yeah. While he was recording that album in the basement every night.
Right. That's right.
That's great. Well, this has been wonderful, George. And I hate to wrap up on a down note, but I do have to say Boston, you know, like I said earlier, it was one of the first albums I ever bought where I knew all the songs. But I also experienced the letdown of the second album not being as good as the first album. Of course, now in hindsight, of course, it would be impossible to top, you know, the first album. Like nothing could top it. But when the second one came out, I liked it, but it just wasn't, it didn't give you the same thrill and the same rush.
I had the exact same reaction. And I have heard Tom explain a little bit of that in doing a bit more research for this podcast. Is two things were happening. Is that, that first of all, his basement studio in which he had recorded the debut album got completely flooded. It wasn't flooded with water. It was flooded with more nasty stuff from the Boston sewers.
Ooh.
Okay. So he was in the process of building a second studio. And at the same time, the record company was really pressing him to do some, to get a second album out really quickly. And I think that I think the implication after that interview was that Because it took him, remember, several years to put together the tunes for that first one. And I think that he would probably say, maybe not saying it out loud, but the implication was that that second album was probably rushed without fully being cooked.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
But I had the same reaction. It was like I bought it and I thought, oh man, it's going to be debut number two. And it just wasn't there.
And it's amazing, as you pointed out, plus, doing all that touring and all that stuff they'd never done before to try to put that album together was an incredible feat that they even got it out, and it's as good as it is. So got to give them some credit for that.
One last thing is that he very un-rock star like is very very modest, is very self-effacing, and he is somebody who has donated lots of his money to charity.
Is that
And
right?
one of the yes, and one of the in fact, he started there's a foundation that he started that donates money. But at one point, he was asked in an interview that said, "Well, hey man, you're really successful. You're making lots of money. Why don't you go out and buy something like a yacht?" And his answer
Yeah.
was very revealing. He said, "Well, you know what? That $1 to $2 million that I would spend on a big fancy yacht, I can put to better use in helping people."
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. That is very un-rock star like. You're right.
Yes.
I could buy a castle in Ireland and record there, but I'm not going to do that.
Right.
That's great. Really wonderful. Well, George, thank you so much. It's been so fun to revisit this record and learn all these details about it. I encourage people, if you haven't, to go back and spin the Boston album one time just for old time's sake. And if you're driving around, it's a great album to roll the windows down and crank up in the summertime, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Patrick. The thing spent 2.5 years on the Billboard 200 and spent over half a year in the top 10.
That's unreal. That's unreal. For a band nobody'd ever heard of.
Yes. 2.5 years on the Billboard top 200 is pretty incredible.
It really is. It really is. No matter who you are, even established bands couldn't do that at the height of their power. So very amazing. Well, George, thank you very much. It's so wonderful to have you on and hear your voice. And hopefully this won't be an isolated time. We'll try to have you on. I know, being a listener to our podcast, you're certainly exposed to a lot of different kinds of music, and I know you listen to all kinds of different stuff. So we'd love to have you as part of the group for sure.
I look forward to it, and thank you very much, Patrick.
Absolutely. Thanks, George. We'll play out with some Boston guys, and we will talk to you guys later. you don't switch the channel when a Boston song comes on. You always play through that Boston song, and you hope it's Tuesday so you get two of them.